it to run from Friday to Friday. He would be looking at the security screen, see me and Finn smiling into the lens. The intercom crackled.
Good evening, madam.
They said this to let me know they could see me.
How may I help you?
Hello, I used to work here and I was passing, and I know it's late, but I was wondering if Albert Mackay is still the manager?
And your name is?
Anna McLean.
Could you wait a moment, please, madam?
Certainly. The mute was employed and we were alone.
McLean? Asked Finn.
It's my maiden name.
I didn't think you and Hamish were married.
We didn't get married, but I changed my surname to Hamish's for the kids.
Oh, he mumbled. You seem to have a lot of names.
He obviously hadn't read the tweets about me. There weren't many compared to the ones about him. He must have just scrolled past them thinking they were irrelevant. But I wouldn't be able to keep it from him forever. I made a note to get my lies in order. The voice crackled awake again.
Come down to the main house, please, madam. Mr. Mackay said you know where the side car park is.
The barrier lifted, and we drove on a road of flawless tarmac, passing stables on the right, a paddock on the left, heading up an incline. As we crested the small hill, the scene opened up as if scenery flats were being raised from below a stage. First, the hills across the water rose into view, pale and round. Then the sea became visible on the left, molten grey with the winking lights of oil rigs in the bay for repair. They stood ankle deep in the shallow water, like giants wading home for tea. Lastly, the castle rose up from behind a screen of strategically grown trees. Finn gave a low, whoa, and I felt a spark of pride as if it were my own house. The castle was turreted and asymmetric, gloriously uplit by spotlights hidden in the shrubbery. It was built of vibrant yellow sandstone and had lights on in every window, each dressed with matching curtains. Despite the scale, it looked welcoming, like we had been invited to someone's lovely home for a party. We drove past and around to the side car park. This was strictly for residents only and was surprisingly empty, just a couple of large cars. I had never been there in November. We got out, locked up and crunched across the thick gravel to the main door. A stone portico, big and high enough to shelter a horse-drawn carriage, shielded the door. The giant storm doors sat open to a stone vestibule with a small cloakroom for wet clothes and muddy hiking boots. The uniformed doorman greeted us very formally and opened the elaborately engraved glass inner door, inviting us into the house proper. He left us to go and find Mr. Mackay. The central hall of Skibo Castle, I have to say, was the most laughably opulent bit of domestic architecture I've ever seen. The room was 2 stories high, with an elaborate carved wooden gallery running all the way around, leading off into the bedrooms. A giant wood log was burning in the oversized fireplace and giving off a soft heat. 2 red sofas flanked it, sitting on a giant Persian rug. But the stairway is where the whole room went nuts. Straight across from the entrance, a massive butterfly staircase had a big church organ under its left armpit. The copper organ pipes glinted, reflecting the lazy fire behind us. At the half landing, where the stairs bifurcated, was a giant wall of stained glass images commissioned by Andrew Carnegie. These depicted the good works performed in vivo by Carnegie. It didn't show him ordering Pinkerton men to shoot at strikers or dodging Frick at parties. It didn't show mutilating accidents and smelting plants. It showed Carnegie in a frock coat, smiling among adoring workers, doling out advice and being admired by the poor. Once, quite drunk, I stood in front of it with Adam Ross, and we laughed for 15 solid minutes at the many layers of stupidity. There is so much screamed symbolism in the hall. It was a mercy that I was never there for Christmas. The doorman came back in and shepherded us through a little door to the dark servants' corridor. Most of the house is given over to hidden corridors for servants to scurry through and stay hidden. We walked down to Albert's office door. The doorman gave it a cursory knock and opened it. The office was small. A coal fire glowed in the grate. Bookshelves of grey box files lined the walls. The desk was immaculately tidy. Nothing on it but a pen and a notebook, closed. Not even a computer. Albert Mackay stood up from his desk and gave a small bow.
"Miss McLean," he said,
as if I had just left the room and come back in again for my scarf. I swear he was wearing an exact copy of the clothes I had last seen him in 9 years before. A white shirt, waistcoat, green moleskin trousers and brogues. We both fought off warm smiles. "Hello, Mr. Mackay. This is my friend Finn." Albert came round the desk and shook Finn's hand. I could see Albert assessing Finn, looking him up and down, pricing his clothes.
"Mr. Cohen, it's very nice to meet you."
Of course he knew who Finn was. It was Albert's job to know who every potential visitor was. His interest in Finn was deferential, which meant that he hadn't researched him and didn't know Finn was penniless.
"What a lovely place," said Finn politely.
Albert thanked him.
"Shall we go to my house?" he said.
But it wasn't a question, and he didn't ask me why I was there, which seemed strange. He lifted his jacket from his chair and led us out and down a corridor to a back door. Outside, we skirted a windless wall of the castle and cut across a grassy verge to a wide private road that led all the way through the grounds. Giant redwoods lined the driveway. The grass on either side was so green and neat that it looked fake. The grounds were very grand, much more so than the house. The castle was set in the tidy wilds, a countryside without the smells or rabbit shit or mud. I liked it. I don't really like the countryside. I said to Albert, "It's very quiet, isn't it? I was surprised they let us in through the main house."
"Mr. Ross called to say you were coming up with Mr. Cohen, and I told them to let you in."
"I need to ask your advice about something." Albert hummed.
"I thought so. Wait until we get into the house."
We took a turn off the main road, down to the left, onto a path that overlooked the glass dome over the swimming pool. We looked down and I nudged Finn so he didn't miss the sight of it. It was dark inside the round glass dome. It looked like a steampunk spaceship neatly parked on the banks of the lake.
"How is Adam?" asked Albert.
"Not dead."
Albert shook his head. "A Lazarean miracle, that boy. Keeps ODing and being brought back from the dead. His poor mother.
God, what he's put her through," I said, but we were both smiling. Adam was so likeable that even ODing sounded like an amusing foible. We were some way down the road before I remembered that we had parked back at the castle. "Should I move my car?"
Albert thought for a moment. "What kind of car is it?"
"BMW."
"What year?"
"Last year. It's an X5.
"Fine, leave it. We're quiet at the moment."
Hamish's car was fancy enough to be parked in the Skibo guest car park. He would have been pleased. Albert led us along the road for a short while and then cut across a side lawn. Frosty grass crunched underfoot. Finn looked up and gave a gratifying coo of appreciation. The cottage had been built as one of the members' luxury lodges, but Albert got to live there because there was a problem with the sauna which was somehow never fixed. The walls were red-stained, slatted wood, left rough at the edges, giving the outer walls an organic, undulating texture. A green porch ran all the way around, and the porch overhang was supported by green-stained tree trunk pilasters, the nubs of amputated branches still discernible. Albert walked up to the porch and stopped at the front door. His hand hesitated on the handle. Fleetingly, I wondered if he had a boyfriend living with him, or a miniature horse for a wife or something, and felt he should introduce the fact before walking us in. But he said nothing and opened the door. I was hyper-vigilant again. I hadn't had that since I left Skipo. It may have been returning here that brought it all back after all these years. It was very uncomfortable. Everything felt like a potential threat. It was hard to filter noise and sights. There was no one in there. It was very plain inside. No personal effects or photos anywhere. It looked like a show home, but that was Albert's style. Luxe functional. He shut the door behind us and asked, "Sherry, anyone?" I teased him. "Who drinks sherry?" "I do." He smiled. "Tea, then?" We settled on that and followed him into the kitchen, which I don't think he liked. There was a single meal from the castle kitchen defrosting on the worktop. It had the calorie count written on the cover, and I thought this might be what he was embarrassed about. We sat at the kitchen table.
"So, what did you want to ask me about, Anna?"
"Do you remember a Dutch club member called Lily Harkan?" He sang suddenly in a rich baritone.
"Lily Harkan, sweet Lily Harkan."
To the tune of Lily Marlene. I joined in and Finn looked confused. Albert explained,
"Ms. Harkan was a rather negative lady."
I clarified, "She was a whiny bitch." Albert rolled his eyes in an all too familiar gesture and told Finn,
"A rather negative and sadly unfortunately mannered lady. Rarely was there an interaction with the staff that did not end in acrimony on her behalf. And so, when we returned to staff quarters to find that softer pillow or whatever, we would sing Lily Marlene,
instead of saying what a cow she was.
Because that leaves you in a bad mood and unable to deliver service to the next guest."
But she was a really grumpy cow. I mean, nothing pleased her. Albert swiped me silent with his finger.
"That's enough."
He wouldn't allow us to say rude things about the guests, even if they were awful. He loved the rich and powerful. He loved the royal family and film stars. He thought they had privilege because they were better than us. He adopted their snobberies and dressed like them. He was the perfect servant, like a functional form of Stockholm syndrome. Adam and I could never have done that. We had no future in service, and Albert had spotted that in both of us.
"Anyway, what about Ms. Harkan?"
"Well, when I worked with her, she came with a boyfriend called Leon Parker. Do you remember him?" He flashed me a warning look. When I was young, that would have been enough to shut me up. But I was older. "Do you remember him?"
Leon Parker was married subsequently, wasn't he? Not to Ms. Harkan."
"He was.
He came to a rather sad end, Mr. Parker, I believe."
"Do you remember him?"
"Only vaguely. I believe we sent him an invitation to revisit shortly after his reported wedding. He didn't respond."
"He must have been very rich then," I said, nodding towards Finn.
"Actually, it was his wife we were interested in."
Finn leaned forward.
"Gretchen Tiegler."
"Did she come?" asked Finn.
"No." There was a cloud in Albert's mood now. He ground his jaw and snarled a little at Finn. He didn't seem to want to talk to him anymore. I knew he had something to tell. I tipped my head at him. "Have you met Gretchen Tiegler?" He scowled at me.
"Leave it."
You have. What's she like?
Very powerful. Leave it, Anna. Sorry, is there a loo down here?
Asked Finn. Albert told him it was upstairs, through the bedroom at the top of the stairs. But I knew there was a toilet just off the kitchen. We watched Finn walk out, heard his feet on the stairs, heard the bathroom lock click shut. Albert, do you know Gretchen Tiegler?
No, but you know Gretchen Tiegler, don't you?
What? He held up a hand to silence me and waited until he heard Finn flush. Then he craned towards me, his face suddenly flush, and whispered,
Aren't you in enough trouble, Sophie Buchanan?
Chapter 24. Finn came back downstairs and found us in a completely altered mood. It wasn't jovial. Albert was frowning and I was frozen with shock. Albert told him we'd decided to go for a walk in the grounds to see what had changed since I was last there. He should wait here, won't be long. He didn't explain why Finn wasn't invited. It was raining a little, and my expensive leather coat wasn't made for hill walking. Albert lent me a wax jacket from his cupboard. We walked out, leaving Finn sitting in the kitchen, bewildered and drinking tea, fiddling with his phone. Finn caught my eye and raised an eyebrow, encouragingly, thinking I was going to ask searing questions about Leon and the Dana. I gave him a stiff smile. I didn't know if I was coming back, or if I would see Finn again, and I was sad about that, which was unexpected because he was very annoying. Outside, the wind had picked up. Flurries of rain swept in from the sea. We walked straight uphill in silence, in the dark, as if it was a chore or we were going somewhere specific. I can't avoid this anymore. I have to explain who I am, where I came from, why I ran. A long-held silence is hard to break. You may have to strain to hear. You will have been told this story before, but only in one way, and not in this way. But you know, often with uncomfortable stories like this, there is a chasm between lip and ear. You might not be able to hear it at all. Chapter 25. If I told you their names, you'd think you know me. You don't. I'm not going to talk about that night at the hotel in Soho. I will not name the footballers. I will not specify which London club they played for. You can go elsewhere for all of that. I will not talk about my injuries, internal or otherwise, or about what happened in court, what was said about me, or my history, or my mum. My mum was a good mum. She did her best. My failings are mine alone. I will not talk about the jury taking under an hour to deliberate on 19 charges. At the beginning, people begged me to talk. I was offered money. They emailed and phoned and came to my door. Human interest, your side of the story, what really happened? You have a responsibility to other girls. It wasn't a tactical decision to stop telling my story. It's just that every time I told it, everything got much, much worse. I came to think of it as an incantation, a lyric curse I brought down on myself. But when I stopped telling it, everyone turned on me, speculating about my motives, about girls like me and what was wrong with us. They said the right to anonymity should be withdrawn in failed rape trials. Then I was named on the internet. The flames were fanned by one of those contrarian columnists. You'd know her name. Her byline back then was, She says what everyone else is thinking. I wondered, is that what everyone else is thinking? She said that it was consensual. All of it. Even the violence. Some girls like it rough. She said I was envious, that I wanted a footballer boyfriend, money and fame, but that I woke up in that hotel room and realised that they had used me instead of the other way round, and I set out to destroy them. That's when I went to the police. She pointed out how much damage my spite could have done. Billions lost in broadcasting rights, bankrupting a financially precarious football club. Thank God for investors like Gretchen Tiegler, willing to bail out a beloved UK institution. I could have ruined careers, finished marriages, damaged children. She is still working, that journalist, still gleefully opining. Chat shows and the phone-ins were full of discussions about the case for weeks. These girls, what are they doing? Going out, dancing, envying? Even my supporters didn't really want the truth. They only wanted the bits that suited their agenda. They were only listening for the crimes of their enemies. I was a jumping-off point for stories they wanted to tell anyway. I was a disappointingly unhelpless victim. My mum was a professor at SOAS. I had an unconditional offer from Balliol. I was very drunk. I still don't think that means they had the right to rape me. The first time I told the story, it was to the police. That was the most memorable time because I heard it back when they played it in court to prove how much of a liar I was. My lip was swollen and split and I was in shock. I sound like someone else entirely, stuttering, slurring, hesitating over details, changing the colours of suits and carpets. The police interview took place in a very small grey room with a steel table bolted to the floor. There was me, two women and a camera. One of the women, DS Patricia Hummingsworth, asked the questions. The other one looked bored and sat back in her chair and stared at me. Patricia tried to be kind at first. I liked her. I told her what happened. She looked at my split lip. Did they do that to you? I touched it. This? She nodded, head tilted, sympathetic. Yes, that. Did they do that?
No, I think I did it before I met them. I fell over on the stairs because I was a bit drunk.
She blinked and withdrew across the table. When she opened her eyes, the warmth was gone. She was never nice to me again. I actually wondered, how did falling over mean consent? She wanted to know how much I drank that night. I tried to remember, but obviously, it turned out later, I'd had a lot more than I thought. This was a big mark against me, as if being drunk in public took away my right to the protection of the law. Was I from a well-off family? I remember how jarring that conversational segue was. Was I from a what? She repeated it. Was I from a well-off family? Well, I don't know. My mum had just died, single parent just died, and she didn't have money. We didn't have money. I was out that night because my mum had just died and I was trying to cheer myself up. Would I say I was feeling reckless that night? Feeling what? I didn't know what was going on. The questioning got fuzzy, broken up. It was all about my state of mind and how I felt when I saw those famous men. I don't follow football. They were wearing suits. I thought they were bankers. I asked her, why are you asking about me? What's that got to do with what they did? Then she asked if I had a boyfriend. Oh, thank God, I thought, she wants someone to come and get me. No, I said hopefully, I don't have a boyfriend at the moment, but my friend Tasha can come for me, she has a car. No boyfriend currently, though? Nice looking girl like you. I thanked her for the compliment. That's very kind of you, but no, I'm not seeing anyone. But Tasha can come and get me. She can drive. Sophie, how did you get that scar on your eye? This? I fell off a bike when I was a kid. Now, looking back, I know what she was asking me. Had I been attacked before? Did I make a habit of being victimised? She asked if I had gone out looking for a boyfriend last night. Oh, God.
I suddenly saw it all from her side. A fall-down drunk, a smashed lip, out on the prowl, saw blokes with money and a car and fame and mothers who are not dead. It was too late to stop telling. I couldn't lie. I was drunk. My mum had just died. I'm entitled to get upset and drunk without being raped and beaten by four men. But I couldn't take it back. And the next thing I knew, we were in court. And then it was finished. Not guilty. There's a famous photograph of one of the footballers wearing a Prada suit, punching the air outside the Old Bailey. Afterwards, everything snowballed. It was everywhere, on chat shows and social media, and everything was about me, why I lied, when I lied. It was never about them. They didn't lose sponsorship deals or work. Their club gave them full support. My name was leaked online, then my address. My house was egged. Eggs breaking on window glass sound like shots fired. A girl spat at me in the street. Men gathered in my garden when the pubs closed and sang the club anthem up at my bedroom window and laughed. Mum's car was burned out in the middle of the night. The cops wanted me to move. I didn't want to. I'd lived there with my mum and she was gone. All the things she'd touched were there. Early one morning, I heard screaming in the street outside my house. A woman was pointing at my front door. Someone had nailed a cat to it. It was a small grey cat, a skinny little kitten, not yet fit to meet the world on its own. The cat had a nail through its head. A trickle of black blood ran down our yellow door. The picture was in the newspaper. That was too much. People care about cats. I was relieved. I thought people would finally see what this was like. They didn't. They said I did it myself, for attention and sympathy. I was a monster. It's hard to lose faith in people when you're young. You never get over that, not really. I hid. I even hid from my friends. So this time was horrible, but it did feel as if it would pass. Until the other girl came forward. I first heard her on the radio at home, reports that a witness had come forward in the rape case. She had been in the hotel suite that night and was giving the police a statement. I didn't remember another girl being there. Would she corroborate my story? If she did, would they retry the case? I couldn't live through that again. Or would she call me a liar? Was she a stooge from the football club? If she did, would they charge me with perjury? Would they jail me? I had no money for bail or lawyers. Paralysed by indecision but needing to do something, I went into the kitchen to find some food. Eating at all was an achievement most days. I focused hard on this one task. I would fry an egg to make a sandwich. I pulled the pan out and poured in too much oil by mistake. I turned the ring on. I went to the fridge for eggs. I broke one and let it slide into the softly bubbling oil. I watched it. Suddenly, my mobile rang and made me jump. It was behind me, on the table. I turned my back to the cooker, picked it up, and looked at the screen. D.S. Patricia Hummingsworth. I can still hear the eggs splutter in the pan behind me. My finger hesitating over the answer button, my heart racing. Hot oil spluttering and the phone in my hand buzzing terror. That was when I felt a calloused hand close on my throat. I saw his dim reflection in the window, dark hair, narrow face. The man was tall and broad. He lifted me up by my waist and neck just as I hit the answer button on the phone. Patricia heard it all. She later gave evidence at the inquiry into my disappearance. She heard me gurgling and choking, a strangled scream and a heavy metallic thud.
Then she heard the phone go dead. When they arrived at the abode, cops talk like this, they found signs of a struggle, but Sophie Buchanan was missing. Blood everywhere, kitchen in disarray. The findings of that inquiry were that I was presumed dead. It turned out the other girl had corroborated my statement. That night, she was passed out in another room, forgotten by everyone. She woke up and heard me screaming for help, begging them to stop. She saw everything, but didn't come forward immediately. She was ashamed because she heard me screaming and just hid. As soon as she gave it, someone leaked her statement to very bad people. Minutes after she gave it, they knew that the case would be retried. They knew before Patricia even called to tell me. They knew billions would be lost, unless I wasn't there to tell that story again. I was 19. I was loathed. I had no family. I was disposable. A disposable girl. What happened in the kitchen that night is blurry, because I've never told anyone about it. But this is what I recall. My feet leaving the floor. The sensation of choking. My phone falling to the table. The man lifting me by the neck and waist, holding me tight to his body as he swung me away from the phone. My arms flailing, hand closing on the frying pan handle. He dropped me and reached back into his waistband for a knife. I spun around, swung the pan at him, and sprayed his face with hot oil. Hot oil stuck to his skin. He reeled, staggering with hands over his face. I clubbed his head with the pan over and over, screaming brute noises. I saw an unfamiliar big knife on the floor and kicked it away. There is a peculiar, sour kind of intimacy in being attacked. I could have identified his hands from a lineup of 100. I knew his smell and the earlobe on his right side. His smell, a blend of cigarettes and stale sandalwood, comes to me still, full, total, and makes me want to run. He was down, but I kept hitting. I kept hitting even though he wasn't moving. There was a lot of blood, very red. I couldn't stop. I kept going until my arms were trembling with exhaustion. I think my mind was back in that hotel room with those men. All the wild panic and terror from then was being taken out on an unconscious, blood-splattered man. I saw some of the burned skin on his jaw slough off, revealing the flesh underneath, and pity made me stop. He was still breathing at that point. I'm pretty sure he was. What could I do? I didn't think I could call the police. They'd find a way to blame me for this too. His breathing was shallow. His eyes were swelling. A cut bloomed on the bridge of his nose. Blood pooled behind him on the floor. He lay very still. Who was he? He wasn't a football fan making a point. He didn't have a football top on or say anything. He was dressed in dark clothes and hadn't shouted threats or anything. He just wanted me to be dead. I searched his pockets. A photo of me taken in the street outside my house. Bus tickets, Tesco receipts, a fat envelope unsealed full of 50 quid notes. £10,000, I found out later. Inside the envelope, I found a business card for Tiegler Inc. A phone number was pencilled on the back with DL scribbled next to it. I'd heard of Dauphine Loire. I knew who Tiegler Inc. were. I glanced down and saw the colour was draining from his face. I thought he was dying. I ran. Up to the bedroom, grabbed pants, passport and a coat. On the way out, I kissed my mum's photograph, held it to my heart. I couldn't take it. This was her house. She belonged here. I kissed her again, put it down, and ran. My passport was new. I thought of running to France, but I didn't know who was after me. If it was Dauphine and the Tiegler organisation, France would be the worst place to go. So, I pulled up my hood and caught a train to Charing Cross. I walked up to Euston and I caught a sleeper train to Fort William, someone I'd never even heard of. I hid in a crappy hotel for weeks, coloured in my distinctive scar with eyebrow pencil, kept my hood up and cut my hair. I spoke little, but when I did, I affected a genteel Scottish accent. Accents are important signifiers of authenticity, and I got good at that one. I became as close to invisible as possible. I had been hiding out for 3 weeks when I met Adam Ross in a supermarket. It was so long since I'd spoken to anyone that my voice sounded strange and strained. It didn't matter. Adam was okay with strange. He was shivering and sweating. He was the sickest alive person I'd ever seen. He started talking about crisps or something. I can't remember what he said. It was 10 in the morning, and he asked me if I had any money, and I said I had some, and he said would I buy him some drink? Not a drink, not drinks. I thought it was a charming regional phrase, but soon found out that Adam literally meant some drink, an unspecified amount of anything with alcohol in it. He'd spent all his money on heroin and needed something. It was a chance to practice my accent. It still wasn't very good, but Adam isn't judgmental. We had a great afternoon in that pub. I didn't even drink much. He did. He said there were jobs going where he worked in the summer, if I wanted one. I was amazed he was employed. The job was live-in, on a private estate with very high security. I said that sounded perfect, but I didn't have papers or want to be found. Adam didn't ask why. He just shrugged and said, aye, okay, look, Fort William is full of tourists passing through, leaving coats and rucksacks lying around unattended. He'd get me a new ID if I wanted. And so I became Anna McLean, and I got the job. I stayed a week, then another week, a month, 8 months in the end. In time, I drifted to Glasgow, met Hamish and had the kids. I had a home. For years, nothing happened. No one was interested in me. I loved Hamish. I need to say that. I can't always remember why anymore, but I recall the feeling, and it was real. The money and the stuff, the payoff for being a rich man's wife, that wasn't why I was with him. I was there despite the money. If you've ever had to run, you know that stuff is just stuff. Even rich people can only stand in one room at a time. When I got pregnant, I remade myself again. I'd stopped smoking and swearing and hitting people with trays. Now I became mild. Anna MacDonald from Glasgow was on the Parents' Council, campaigned for a new lamination machine for the school office. I shopped and read a lot. I couldn't go abroad because my passport was in the wrong name, so I said I was afraid of flying, and we holidayed in Cornwall. That was the best life of all my lives. But as the girls grew, the strain began to tell. Old Anna was scratching away from the inside. Resentments came back first, then the aggression, and that was hard to hide. Reading and listening to stories in the early morning helped me get my mask on straight. Estelle Cohen was the first person to see me. Trophy wife to trophy wife, she saw the conflict and layers that there was more going on. As I came out of the stupor of early motherhood, Sophie started coming back. That was who Estelle saw. Now I have no mask left. I am not Anna MacDonald, née McLean, soft-spoken younger wife from somewhere outside of Aberdeen. I am Sophie Buchanan, the disposable girl, and I am not yet dead. The disposable girl should develop a drink problem or take drugs. She should become the victim of someone else, somewhere else. At best, she becomes a campaigner against whatever she was a victim of. nothing can happen to her that doesn't refer back to the attack. She has been branded. The event owns her. She can only ever exist in reference to it. But that's not true, because the world is full of us. 1 in 5. We are as perennial as love. We go about our business, raising kids, running countries, starting wars and solving crimes. We don't tell our stories because if we've survived, that can only mean that what happened wasn't so very bad after all. It never means that we are fucking amazing. I am fucking amazing. When I was 19, I ran so fast I left a branding behind. And I have stories to tell that are more than titillating details or pleas for your pity. This is just one of them. Chapter 26. We walked up a hill overlooking the sea. Albert?
Not yet. He strode on ahead.
Albert knew who Sophie Buchanan was. He'd heard somehow about Gretchen Tiegler. I knew that the further we got from the house, the worse whatever he had to tell me was. My heart rate slowed to a treacly bump. A familiar numbness crept over me.
The body develops a tolerance to adrenaline. At a certain level, all that remains is a paralysing ennui. Heavy-footed, I followed him to a copse of trees on a hillside. He sat down in deep shadow, scanning the horizon. I copied him. We were looking out over the Firth and the North Sea. The lights of Dornoch glinted in the distance and a faint, sour smell of fermented barley wafted over from the Glenmorangie distillery. Far away, a toy town car rolled over the bridge, twin headlights cutting through the dark. There was a time when I was so watchful I could tell the size of a car from the sound of the engine. Albert reached into his pocket and took out a packet of cigarettes. The brand was Marlboro Lights, a big favourite from 20 years ago. It was a middle-class brand, low tar, and that spoke of an aspiring quitter who'd smoked heavily at one time. "Didn't know you smoked, Albert." He took one out for himself and handed me the packet.
"Should try to quit."
I took one and gave it back. "I just started again today."
"How are you finding it?"
"Disgusting. I love it." He half smiled as he lit up. His eyes seemed sad, but it was dark and his face was hard to read. I could see that his jaw was tight, his lips bloodless. I asked him, "How long have you known I was Sophie?"
"Since Leon Parker was here with Harkan."
His voice had dropped.
"He asked me if Gretchen Tiegler was a club member. He'd been chasing her for quite some time, I think. He said you knew her name, asked if I had mentioned her to you. It was quite sneaky the way he did it. I said yes, I had, but I hadn't. I did a bit of research after that, traced you."
"It was that easy?" He looked at my scar and touched his eyebrow.
"That's a fairly distinctive mark. The police posters were everywhere.
Do you know what happened to her?"
"Gretchen?" "Not Gretchen."
He cast me a reproachful look.
"The other girl. She hid, but they found her. She wasn't as good at it as you. You have quite a talent."
"Who found her?"
"Who do you think?"
We sat with that for a while. Then Albert said,
"She was quite a troubled person. She had a drugs problem. She grew up in a foster family."
What difference did her background make?
Albert meant no harm, but he made it sound like a mercy killing. The murderer's difficult background would be relevant, not hers. I was dismayed by Albert parroting that crap at me.
But he worked in a luxury resort. He sucked up to rich people all day. He dressed like them, toadied to them, shared their values.
He really wasn't the most critical of thinkers. We probably needed to stay off the subject of politics if I was going to keep liking him. I sat and smoked and talked myself out of saying anything to correct him. The sweat from the hill climb was cooling on my clothes. The wax jacket held it against my skin. I'm quite disappointed in Leon for telling you that, I said, actually talking about Albert. I liked him.
Did you?
Didn't you?
He shrugged.
He was my age. As a contemporary, I'd judge him a little differently from you.
How would you judge him?
He pressed his lips tight and shrugged.
On the make, relying on his charm,
a good nose for the money, a bit desperate. Desperate like he was broke.
Well, I think he was very wealthy at one time, but not any more.
I liked him. At the time I thought he was, you know, a guest, but maybe under other circumstances he could have been my friend.
He gave a cynical smile and drew on his cigarette. They're not your friend, Anna. Ever, ever, ever. Remember that.
He looked at me for a while. It felt quite final, as if he was looking at me for the last time, and he said, very quietly,
keep your head down. Get away from that bloody Cohen bloke. He's drawing attention.
I don't want any trouble.
Keep out of sight or you'll get it. Tiegler can't afford any complications like you suddenly appearing in public, not right now. Her company has finally taken a controlling stake of the club. They now own 2 square miles of undeveloped land in central London. Can you even imagine the value of that?
They can't sell off a stadium. There'd be a massive public outcry.
They won't. They'll manage it badly and be forced to sell it to pay their debts. It'll take a long time. It's all legal, but at a very delicate stage right now.
This is the worst time for you to reappear. You need to hide, especially now the feminists are involved.
The what?
The feminists. You're a hashtag. Hashtag justice for Buchanan.
That explained why I had dropped off Finn's Twitter feed.
Well, he continued, the feminists are amplifying it all, calling out the people threatening you. They've traced IP addresses and they're naming them. They'll make it impossible for you to keep your head down.
I wanted to say that rapist footballers and billionaires and hired hitmen were the people who were making things difficult for me, not allies. But he was like an uncle to me, and politics is not always for the kitchen table. I had to say something, though, so I said quietly, I don't think feminists is a proper noun.
Albert smiled at that. We smoked our cigarettes. It hurt my throat, so I drew it in deep and looked out over the sea. I struggled to remember why I liked Albert. I had felt safe here because of Albert. I remembered his patience when I couldn't find Anna McLean's national insurance number. I was nervous about it, kept my bag packed, ready to run. A month into the job, he stopped asking for it and said that HMRC had sent him the number. I was too afraid to ask what happened. I asked, did you hide me? That thing with the national insurance number? He smiled, so wide and unguarded that for the very first time, I saw he had a dimple in his cheek.
Well, it was nothing, he said humbly. I'm glad you made it. Let's go back down.
We stood up and brushed ourselves off. Albert kicked the flattened grass to hide the marks we had made. I watched him and wondered why we'd come all the way up here for this conversation. He could have whispered all of this while Finn was upstairs. We were here so that no one ever knew Albert had helped me, because there would be consequences for him if they did. He'd protected me and hadn't even noticed. He had been the friend I thought Leon was. Albert, I put my hand on his forearm. Thank you. He stopped breathing and tensed as if I had tasered him. It was an electric moment. What I meant was, thank you for giving me this extra time, for my girls, for the moments of peace I have known, for the books I got to read,
For my flawed and cowardly Hamish, whom I still love, for Christmases and all this extra life. The years he gifted me felt like a story I told myself as I bled to death on the kitchen floor in my mother's house. He blinked hard at my hand until I took my hand away. We tramped downhill, hard on the knees as descents often are, heading back to the cottage. A lone rabbit darted across a dark field. It was lovely to be back in the hills under a big grey moonless sky, air to breathe, abrupt freedom in an ancient, half-forgotten land full of lies and people who don't belong. As we walked back down, I thought more about the national insurance number. Something bothered me. The chronology was wrong. Albert got the number a month after I arrived here, but Leon didn't come until 7 months later. Had Albert always known who I was? Did he recognise me when I turned up for the interview? Why not say so now, then? I looked at the back of his head and decided not to ask. The intimacy of my saying thank you was awkward enough. We followed a line of trees, skirting the drive, making our way back round to the kitchen door. The cottage glowed, warm and inviting. My toe was dipping into the pool of light around the cottage when Albert stopped me dead with a raised hand. We could see through the French windows into the kitchen. Finn was sitting at the table, clutching the arms of the chair, looking up, looking scared. In front of him stood a brawny man in dark clothing. He was holding a hunting knife to Finn's face. Chapter 27. We snuck up to the house, keeping to the shadows. Finn was speaking. The man was speaking, but his voice was so low I couldn't hear what he was saying. Finn's voice was uncharacteristically high.
No. No what? Said Finn. I came here with a friend to see someone. No, I didn't know why. I didn't even know where this is. Not really. No, I don't have a gun. Why would I have a gun? This is my phone.
He held it up to show the man.
What are you doing with that big fucking knife?
Flushed to the wall, still in the dark, Albert reached for the door handle. I expected him to kick his way through the door, but he didn't. He just opened the door, not even terribly quickly, stepped into the kitchen and shouted, "You!" The man swung round to face us. He was nothing to do with the castle. Skibo security men dress as gillies, in discreet, off-the-peg outdoorsy gear, tweed coats and green trousers. This man was dressed in nondescript black clothing like the man in my kitchen all those years ago. Dull, dreary clothes that no one would remember seeing, jacket and trousers that evoked no associations or comment. He looked at me, dead-eyed.
Sophie Buchanan.
From the corner of my eye, I saw him slide the knife into a leather sheath on his waistband. It caught the overhead light and flashed. Finn was very close. He was staring wildly at it.
Sophie Buchanan?
Finn stood up.
What in the fuck is actually going on right now?
The man lifted his hand almost languorously and jab-punched Finn on the solar plexus. Finn gasped and dropped back into his chair like a kitten swatted off a lap. I ran across the room.
Don't you fucking touch him!
And reached over to shove the man away, but he smirked and grabbed my elbow joint, pinching pressure points until I was seeing white flashes. My knees buckled. He reached back for his knife.
Not in here, please.
Albert spoke loud and slow. The grip loosened on my elbow. The man looked at Finn wheezing and holding his chest, looked around the room and saw how consequential that might be. He gave Albert a small bow, and Albert nodded towards the front door, walked past, and the man followed, tightening his grip on me, taking me with him. We filed out of the kitchen. Finn stood up, but I glared at him to sit back down and stay. The man saw my warning and hesitated.
What's the point? I said. Look at him. He's half dead anyway.
He might have trouble managing both of us, even with Finn looking so weedy. The space between his thighs was big enough to accommodate another thigh. The man huffed a laugh and tightened his grip on my arm, yanking me out of the cottage and down the steps, hurrying to catch up with Albert. We headed into the shrubs, following a path between old hedges. Albert was in front of us. He didn't glance back. It was a strange walk, not long, but tense. Each passing second, I expected Albert to lead us across a tripwire, turn and shoot, turn and karate chop like an old-fashioned hero. But with every step, Albert did nothing. Time slowed down. I was ignoring the obvious. Why did Albert's hand hesitate on the door handle on the way into his house? When did he realise I was Sophie? Why did he make me go up the hill? We were passing a line of dark trees when Albert looked back. I thought he was signalling to me. He wasn't. Albert and the man locked eyes. Too long. An understanding. They had a plan. Albert had taken me out walking to give the man time to get into the house. He knew I was Sophie Buchanan all along. Albert was never with me. He hadn't given me a job and good references. He'd been holding me and keeping track. I was a bargaining chip and he was cashing me in while my value was high. Albert, I pleaded, he's going to kill me. He couldn't meet my eye. I shouted at him. You soulless fucking lickspittle! He's gonna fucking kill me! The nape of Albert's neck blushed and he hurried on ahead. We walked into the staff car park. Albert raised his hand, pressed a fob. A car winked through the dark and we walked over to it. The hand tightened on my arm. Refusing to look at me, Albert opened the back door of the car and stepped away. The man cupped the top of my head and pushed down, shoving me into the back seat roughly. I landed on my side. He lifted my feet and pushed them in. He stepped back and raised a hand to slam the door. Then, out of nowhere, a hill fell on us. Chapter 28. The door was gone. The men were gone. The night was still. I scrambled upright and saw the car door skidding freestyle across the ground. It came to a stop. I heard a groan. A body was on the ground, 30 feet away, moving in the dark. Twin red lights blinked and reverse lights came on. It was Hamish's car. The lights had been off and the engine was so quiet that I'd had no warning of it coming towards them at 50 until it ploughed into us and ripped the door clean off. It backed up wildly, spraying gravel in a wide arc and pulled up next to me. The front passenger door flew open. Finn Cohen was in the driving seat. I leapt out of the back seat and clambered in. Finn drove off at high speed before I'd shut the door. I slammed it and held tight to the seat as car alarms, seatbelt undone, door open, all blared in the cabin. In the side mirror, I saw Albert get up and stagger, head in hands, and the knife man roll over on the ground, clutching his arm. Finn drove up and over the little hill heading for the main gate. The barrier was down. It was a heavy metal barrier, an anti-terrorist measure. I remembered it going in. Would never get through it. But Finn took a sharp left, crashed through the wooden fencing around the paddock, drove across rough, grassy ground for 100 yards, and then crashed through another part of the fence, completely skirting the metal post, made it out onto the road. He took a skidding right-hand turn, scraping in front of a heavy goods lorry before flicking the lights on. We sped away from the lorry's indignant horn, heading for the bridge over the Firth of Dornoch and the south. Aware that the airbag folded on the dashboard was on my side now, I fumbled my seatbelt on. Finn was wild-eyed.
Phone the police,
No, no, please.
I just ran over two men, Anna. We have to call the police.
I grabbed his elbow. Please, Finn, please, no police.
Why did he call you by Adam Ross's girlfriend's name?
I don't know.
Did you and Adam rob that place?
He was miles out.
For money for heroin?
He said, drifting further still from the truth. Yes, I said, too quickly for it to be a credible lie. I should have hesitated. Yes, we did. He didn't believe me, but kept driving, bent tight over the steering wheel, alert to the rear view, watching the road, keeping the curbs in his eyeline. We reached a stretch of the A9 that was long and straight. If they were following, they couldn't fail to find us. We can hide in here for a bit, I said. Pull in left. The Glenmorangie distillery did a good tour. I'd been there several times, even though I don't like whiskey much. But I knew a spot around the back we could hide in. We pulled down this steep turn with the lights off and parked. I said I thought we should wait, let them pass. We sat in silence for a moment.
So, said Finn, eyebrows high, I don't believe that about Adam.
Why?
You're not an addict.
You don't know that.
I don't like you enough for you to be a heroin addict. You're not the type. But I take it you left that job under something of a cloud?
You're a good driver, I said, weakly trying to change the subject. Have you got any tobacco left? He fumbled the tobacco pouch out of his pocket, handing it to me, tucking it back as a bargaining chip.
So, who is Sophie Buchanan?
He'd misheard the name. He wouldn't be able to Google me. Just a name I used at one point. He stared incredulously, as if he was seeing me for the first time.
Are you a thief?
No.
An industrial spy or something like that?
That sounded like a good lie to go with, but I was in shock and wouldn't be able to spin it convincingly. It's about... I didn't know what to say. Things that happened a long time ago.
Anna, he had a bloody big knife. And as you are no doubt aware, I am knife-to-the-face phobic.
He was being very formal, I think because he was so scared. I didn't know that was going to happen.
We should call the police.
He reached for his phone and I grabbed his hand. We really shouldn't call the police. His eyes raced across my face.
I haven't the faintest fucking idea what you're getting at. Was Knife Man the police?
No, the cops are good guys, but... I saw my leather coat lying in the back seat. Finn must have found the car keys in the pocket back at Albert's cottage and run to the guest car park. He must have pulled out onto the drive. He could have left and kept himself safe, but he didn't. He doubled back and came for me. Why didn't you just drive away?
Haven't got any money for petrol.
Oh.
I considered it. I knew I'd feel really guilty.
He was honest. I admired that.
We're not really here because you think Leon is innocent, are we?
I sighed. It's a bit more complicated, yes.
Tell me a short version.
I struggled to find a starting point. Well, I'm not really from Aberdeen.
Right.
I'm from London.
Mm-hmm. Do you know that guy with a knife?
No.
He's not your ex?
Never met him before. Someone sent him to get me, to kill me.
There's a contract out on you.
He smirked.
What the fuck? You're a housewife.
I hesitated too long and he said,
okay, if you decide to stop lying and tell me what the fuck is really going on, I'd really appreciate it. But will they call the police?
I smiled.
No. McLean, Buchanan, MacDonald. I will find out who you are, you know.
I laughed.
No way. You'll starve first. Don't hold your breath. Estelle's been waiting for that for years.
He looked at the dark drive out to the road.
Let's chance it.
He put the lights on and restarted the engine. He took my goading in good part, but I instantly regretted it. I tried to go back and temper it. You don't have to starve. His smile was strained.
It's not a lifestyle choice.
People overcome addictions, you know.
Oh, do they? He said flatly. Interesting. Well done them.
I think he'd had that conversation quite often, possibly with many different people.
He pulled up the steep drive to the road and nudged cautiously forwards, looking left and right for the telltale glare of lights on the